get on the I-2 for another night. Oh, people thirsty, dying by the roadside. Oh, and jumping off the bridge, committing suicide. Babies crying, mama. Many nations around the world have incorporated human rights provisions into their legal framework and now provide more basic rights to their people than the United States. In key instances, international human rights standards are broader and more protective than the U.S. Constitution or domestic civil rights laws. At this moment in history, the notion of applying a universal human rights framework to the United States seems to be striking a chord with activists around the country.
What do we want?
Human rights!
I think human rights are important, especially for young people, because it shows how people that don't know their human rights are being violated every day. Young people should also get involved in human rights because you don't have to be an adult to change the world.
To you, we speak the truth. To you, we speak the truth.
This is Ajamu Baraka, Executive Director of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and you're listening to No Retreat, No Retreat, Compromise.
No Retreat, Compromise. No Retreat. Compromise.
Bernadine Dorn talks about the United States' role as a pervader of violence around the world in this audio clip from the U.S. Human Rights Network first biannual conference in 2005 at the inception of the war in Iraq. 4 years later, thousands more dead, her message still rings true and relevant. Dorn examines five new frameworks with which to utilize the human rights framework: conceptual, linguistic, organizing, participatory, and legal. The U.S. is 4.8% population of the world's people and has 6% of the world's wealth. Following Bernadine Dorn, you will hear from Andrea Smith, Indigenous activist with Insight, Women of Color Against Violence, a plenary speaker and member organization. Andrea speaks briefly about the historical legacies of colonization on the Indigenous community and makes the link between the five conceptual tools mentioned by Dorn and highlights how the human rights framework allows social justice activists to challenge U.S. state power not only to past and present human rights abuses, but to the continued effects of those violations.
Bernadine Dorn is our next speaker. Sister Bernadine is director of the Children and Family Justice Center and also clinical associate professor of the Northwestern University School of Law, Blum Legal Clinic. The center is a holistic children's law center and a national policy center for the comprehensive needs of adolescents and their families, providing critical analysis and knowledge about youth law and practice, matters associated with the administration of the justice, and the preparation of professionals who advocate for children. She has a long history, as do all of our panelists, that could not be summed up in these bios. But for those of us who have been familiar with her work, as with the other panelists, for years, we know that this is just a brief sampling, and we thank you so much for your work. We're ready to come share with your team.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I want to thank John Baraka for, and Rosalind Satchel, and especially all of the staff and team from the center who put together this extraordinary thing. I think, I really predict that we will look back 5 years from now and see this as a real turning point. Rosalind gave you my tidied up bio. and so I'm gonna actually take the prerogative of stepping back a little bit and looking not at children's rights, which will be a part of this, but at the big issues. Franz Fanon, one of my favorite sentences from all of Fanon, said, "I battle for the creation of a human world, that is," he said, "a world of reciprocal recognition." To me, reciprocal recognition cuts right to the heart of what is in the potential for human rights, of human rights, of the edifice, the conception, the framework, the language, the world of human rights. The essence of it is reciprocal recognition. I'm going to begin by saying, though, where in the world are we? You know, people in the United States are infamous around the world for not knowing who we are or where we are. So I'm just going to try to say a few things. I know you all know this, and many say it more powerfully, but I think it goes to how we build a strategy. Dr. King, in the last and most radical year of his life, said, "The greatest purveyor of violence on the planet today is my own country." 1968. This is not the Dr. King, you know, the sanitized Dr. King. Yeah, this is the angry pilgrim that many of us got to know, okay? Read the last year of Dr. King's writing, where he was arguing for revolution. And at the height of the Cold War, the height of the Vietnam War, he asserted that the United States was the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. That is surely true now. We face, I think, an empire at home today that is characterized by the Gulf War and the Gulf Coast. To me, those two things that characterize our reality, empire and racism, racism and poverty and absolute crushing of people, characterize where we are. This is the most aggressively virulent time in our history. Permanent war, 2,000 American soldiers dead, 30,000 wounded and disabled, over 100,000, we don't know how many Iraqis dead and disabled. And human rights begins with the platform that every life is equally valuable, reciprocal recognition. Urge us every time we talk about the war and its consequences to insist on the recognition of Iraqi lives. We are a land where race and rights mix in a way in every sector and in every crevice of American life that can only properly be characterized as apartheid. Now, American apartheid is taboo. We are absolutely prohibited from talking about it. And I want to say one particular word. You don't have time for analysis, but I want to say that I believe that the weight of white supremacy is the responsibility of white people to take on. It is not the responsibility of Now, you have gathered here some people who possibly can hear the discourse, but all of us need to struggle to be reminded to hear the reality of what this means. If it is true that we live in an apartheid culture, many things follow from that. If it's only rhetoric, so be it. But I believe that it's true. I believe anywhere you look, you will see confirmation of it. We also have the most militarized, secret, invasive, repressive society, rationalized now as national security state. With torture at home and abroad, detention without charges or trial or any scrutiny. We are more authoritarian and savagely unequal, I believe, more entrenched into white supremacy than we've been since slavery. Over 2.1 million people behind bars, the vast majority of people of color for nonviolent offenses. Unemployment of our young people in communities of color is really very similar to the unemployment of young people in the rings around Paris and in the favelas of Brazil. I think we should draw our strength from what we see around the world and identify with it. Torture, shock and awe, extrajudicial assassinations are official policy, and therefore the responsibility of all of us to take them. I mean, to me, the picture this week of the four oil executives in front of Congress says it all. I hope we all have it on our doors and our refrigerators, you know. There it is. Bloody windfall profits from the Gulf Coast. Confident that they're justified in these profits and secure in the notion that they've earned this money. In a country which has the highest child poverty rate, 21%, in the so-called developed world. 21% in the richest country in all of human history of child children are being born into relative poverty. And the greatest income transfer of wealth from working people to the rich through all you know. Human rights, I believe, offers us the possibility, not the certainty, but the possibility of linked movements, maybe a movement, but surely linked movements, where we can draw on an old discourse and use a new discourse, not use, but embody, embrace. The old is important because it's not just started, it didn't just start 50 years ago. We know that this comes out of decades, centuries of the anti-slavery movement, of humanitarian law, or the law of war, and of labor rights struggles. That's our heritage, and we can build into that heritage. Ida B. Wells, Jane Addams, Frederick Douglass, Smith, Malcolm X, the Puerto Rican independence movement, the feminist movement, indigenous rights, child labor, worker rights, land rights. These are our heritage, these are our history, and these are the building blocks of human rights. Five new frameworks. Well, that's the old. I think there's five new kind of ways I try to think about how what human rights is going to mean for us now. One, and maybe this is too, I don't know. One is, I think there's these elements, conceptual, linguistic, organizing, participatory, and legal. The conceptual is important because human rights, I think, challenges U.S. isolation, hegemony, and empire. It can challenge U.S. exceptionalism in the world. We're 4.8, we, the United States population, 4.8% of the world's people. 4.8% of the world's people, 60% of the world's wealth, okay, is here. It challenges, I think, that kind of exceptionalism around issues like the death penalty, around being the only country in the world that hasn't ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child, around the extraordinary open practice of torture today, around the denial of economic rights while giving lip service to civil and political rights. It challenges it because there's new groups recognized, children, indigenous, immigrant rights, because it posits dignity as the central concept. I think that notion of reciprocal recognition, if you look at all of human rights body of law, at the end of the day, dignity, I would argue, is at the heart of it. And because it integrates economic and social rights. Indivisibility of human rights is important. It's relational, and I think this gives us the possibility in this fragmented United States of some kind of movement building that is relational and has connections with each other, has bridges with each other, has unity, recognizes its unity and its differences. Secondly, the linguistics, I think, matters, not because we're using it exactly, but because it gives us words in a new framework. It allows us to get out of some of the things that where meaning has been sucked dry, as you mentioned, the Bill of Rights, you know. And that it gives us new frameworks. For me, for example, the notion of children deprived of their liberty is very different than saying juvenile justice. It assumes that children have a right to liberty, right? It assumes that they are the actors in history. The same for the notion that what you do in criminal justice or with refugees or with child soldiers is recovery, rehabilitation, and reintegration. The language, I think, is helpful here because it sets us on a path. Arrest and incarceration as a last resort. This language, I find, not just language, it's values, it underpins our rights, the highest available standard of health care. So knowing this, popularizing it, giving it as tools to people to use, I think, is helpful. But it's also organizing from below. I would argue that globalization from below is what we embrace. It puts the U.S. into a global framework. I urge all of us to go to the World Social Forum, send people from our organizations to the World Social Forum. It's going to be in Caracas the last week of January. It's only going to be hemispheric this year. But when we see what's going on in the Southern Hemisphere here, it's so inspiring and hopeful. I mean, I don't want to overstate it. And if we got off their back, it would be much more inspiring and hopeful. But, you know, what I mean is that we can be part of that, or we can only be the problem. And I think it's important for us to go there and learn and connect to that. Participatory. I think human rights is participatory. I can't do 1 minute. Okay, I'm going to go to the bathroom. I think it's got democracy in that moment. Therefore, I think the most important thing for us around educating and organizing and mobilizing around human rights is to build a radical, independent social justice movement. Or movements. I'm open to how it's going to play out around movements. Radical, independent. Of our own change. Neoliberal hegemony, with paternalism, and we know, all of us here know, that human rights is kind of the issue du jour for a lot of people that don't have the same interests that we have at heart. And so part of the brilliance of organizing this network is to shape it ourselves, to give it to the people who have the tools to contest the meanings, to contest the meanings from the get-go, and to insist on their radical nature. I think that, I must say, I'm going to give you one example of what we just did in Chicago, which is that John Burge ran the Area 2 police station for 17 years in Chicago, outside of Chicago. It started in Vietnam. It's an incredible story. Comes there, and suddenly African-American men are being tortured with electric shock, with burnings, with suffocation. And slowly, a team of lawyers, Stan Lewis, Flint Taylor, People's Law Office in Chicago, over this period of time, pulled this story of police torture out. We now have 135 documented cases of police torture of African Americans in Chicago. 2 weeks ago, we went to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, a coalition of us from Chicago, including survivor victims. We made it up. We had I have met now 7 different organizations here who've been to the Inter-American Commission. We had no idea. And part of the exciting thing about being here, I think, is seeing what each other's done and being able to learn from it. We got incredible press back in Chicago. We're hoping to get the special rapporteur in race there to go into the community to give hope to people about the fact that someone is listening. We don't have very many remedies there, and much of human rights doesn't give us immediate remedies, but it does give us the notion that we can transform our voice, that there's a liberatory politics. How do we find our voice with a moral conscience and rage? Can't be alive today without rage.
Yeah, right.
But we need to temper that rage, of course, as an old person, with moral conscience constantly. I believe that we must build bridges, because look at the body of organizing work that's going on. Just look here today. Incredible organizing going on in the United States, and yet we don't feel the power of a movement, whatever mysterious thing that is. And we don't know when it'll spark up, but we do know that the work that is being done here is a necessary predicate for that work. I'll close with the words of Gwendolyn Brooks, the magnificent poet laureate of Illinois. She wrote these words about Paul Robeson, but I think they apply always. Urging us to keep that voice, warning us that we are each other's magnitude and bond.
My name is Andrea Smith, A-N-D-R-E-A, then S-M-I-T-H.
And the name or the organization that you represent?
Incite Women of Color Against Violence in the Boarding School Healing Project.
Okay. Basically, we have 2 questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
First question is, why is a U.S. human rights network or movement important to your work?
Well, the status of indigenous peoples in the U.S. is one of colonialism. We're being actively colonized by the U.S. government. And the human rights framework is important because human rights are understood as those rights that a state cannot take away. So therefore, a human rights framework is one that challenges state power. And because Native peoples are such a small minority of the population in the U.S., it's very important for us to be in coalition with other peoples who see the importance of challenging U.S. state power.
Okay. Second question. Tell us about a way or a story on how you use the human rights framework to move your work forward.
Well, the Boarding School Healing Project adopted a human rights framework. I've been involved in the anti-violence movement for about 17 years, particularly focused on issues of sexual violence in Native communities. And there's been such an overwhelming silence around this issue in our communities where people just don't want to deal with it. And a large part of the reason they don't is because the sexual abuse is a legacy of boarding schools where Native peoples were taken from their homes and forced to attend these Christian boarding schools where they were routinely sexually and physically abused. And then when they came back to their communities, they started to enact the same patterns of abuse that had been perpetrated against them. And they have so much individual shame around it that they don't want to talk about this issue. So we frame the boarding school healing project as a human rights issue because according to international law, the U.S. is mandated to address the continuing effects of human rights abuses. So not just the abuses they perpetrated, but the continuing effects that have resulted from these abuses. So therefore, the U.S. has a responsibility to, say, fully fund substance abuse programs, anti-violence programs, etc., and not to defund them when it's inconvenient, because these are all the colonial legacies that we are suffering as a result of boarding schools. And then this also became a way of educating Native peoples about the issue of sexual violence, because we were able to say that this sexual violence is not because we're dysfunctional and because of just simple interpersonal patterns of abuse, but it is in fact the continuing effect of human rights violations perpetrated by state policy. So it is not something we need to be embarrassed or ashamed about, but recognize how it's part of this colonial legacy. And if we actually want to decolonize, like we always say we want to do, then we need to put abuse front and center in part of our decolonization program. So it became a way, one, of interjecting a feminist perspective on issues of reparations. Because when we look at the harms done by slavery and genocide, one of the harms is that violence has been internalized in our communities. So even if we're victimized by, say, a man in our community that's the primary perpetrator, that violence is still a colonial or slave legacy that the state should also be accountable for. Then this, in turn, gives us an anti-colonial intervention in the anti-violence movement, because then we stop seeing the state as the solution to ending violence by, say, getting more police involved in domestic abuse cases, etc., and recognize the state is the perpetrator of violence, and it's not going to be the solution to all the problems that it's created. So that's kind of how the human rights framework has kind of advanced our work.
Underlying all human rights work in the United States is a commitment to challenge a belief that the United States is inherently superior to other countries of the world, and that neither the U.S. government nor the U.S. rights movement have anything to gain from the domestic application of human rights. Network members believe that the U.S. government should no longer be allowed to shield itself from accountability to human rights norms, and that the U.S. civil, disability, women's, workers, immigrant, LGBTQ, prisoner impunity, and other rights movements that stand to benefit perhaps now more than ever from an end to U.S. impunity in this regard. For more information on how to join the U.S. Human Rights Network, visit us online at www.ushrnetwork.org. Human Rights No Retreat, No Compromise podcast is a production of the U.S. Human Rights Network produced by Ajamu Baraka, Sunyata Altenor, and John B.F. Williams, with Sugar Matthews, Tonya Williams, Drina Brown, Kalia Kunu, and Rachel Fowler. U.S. Human Rights Network at www.ushrnetwork.org.
In its wake, Katrina left a ravaged Gulf Coast and a nation shocked by the images of poverty and neglect that it revealed.
To the extent that the federal government didn't fully do its job right, I take responsibility. And it was